morning, everyone. Welcome to the House Judiciary Committee. You're probably surprised you're here. We're surprised we're here. But it seems like it was the a good thing to do. The public will have an opportunity to be in the room with us because we have the camera there. And sometimes I wonder how many people actually watch, but the telephone calls that come back are often many more than I would have guessed that says, oh, yeah, that was good. So we're here. Let's take attendance first. Representative Lynn is here, Representative Keller, Representative Pruitt. We're waiting on Representatives Gruenberg and Holmes. Vice Chair Thompson next to me and myself, Chair Gatto. First thing is housekeeping. The proverbial cell phones need to be disarmed.
Thanks for mentioning that.
Although we shouldn't be getting calls at 8 in the morning. The committee members have really been listening to, I think, four or five. Here comes Representative Gruenberg now. Got it. Committee members have heard the floor speeches given on the Senate side, heard some of the floor speeches given on the House side. Those are floor speeches. People on each of those sides have had very strong opinions to advance or support or deny their own personal perspectives. So I thought it was a pretty good idea that we get this one shot before we all went home and were able to at least tell our constituents the issue that kept us here for 30 days really was one thing, and that's these sections in the bill on contingency and severability. That was what kept us here. It wasn't that we couldn't agree on the components of the capital budget. We stood our ground on this side of the building and said we're not going to allow that language to stay in the bill. And what happens at this point with that language is not the subject of the meeting. What is the subject of the meeting is to essentially try to hear proverbially from the horse's mouth. I'm sorry if that's offensive, but to get it straight from the Attorney General and from the Director of Legal? What do I call it? Our legal people. Okay. And so Doug Gardner. And I have to tell you one thing I discovered about Doug just the other day. You're the Attorney General, but Doug is a bagpiper. I was impressed. As we had the Fisherman's Memorial, and I'm walking along, and here comes somebody that looks just like Doug, wearing the kilts and carrying the bagpipes, and I said, that is Doug. And he said, hi, and seven members, I think, played the bagpipes and at the Fisherman's Memorial, which was a nice day. So what I'm going to do now is, I don't intend this to be a debate between two sides. The debate will come from us to a presenter and the presenter back to us. And we're going to probably come up with some questions. But so first I'd like, and I know there are some deadlines here. You have to be out of the building by 11. I'll honor that completely. So if you would, Attorney General Burns, come up first and just make a presentation to us, and then we'll relax you and we'll have Mr. Gardner come up and make a presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Yeah, as always, it is a distinct pleasure to appear before the committee. My name is John Burns, and I have the privilege of serving as the Attorney General for the state of Alaska. My understanding is that the House Judiciary Committee has invited me here today and is requesting an explanation from the Department of Law as to why we feel, as we do, that the contingency and non-severability language that appears in the versions in the version of the capital budget that has recently, as of last night, been transmitted from the Senate to the House is unconstitutional. At the outset, I would note that until such time as the legislature actually passes the capital budget, any discussion as to the unconstitutionality of anticipated language is purely speculation, since there is always the distinct possibility that that language will be removed before final passage. in the interest of avoiding both litigation as well as jeopardizing any of the various energy projects that comprise the appropriation. My responsibility as Attorney General, and in fact the responsibility of all public officials, whether they be elected or appointed, is to uphold the Constitution. Politics must always yield to the constitutional provisions and principles that govern the administration of our state. This issue is not about building a better mousetrap. The issue is about process and the integrity of adhering to constitutional principles. The principles of our democratic form of government are grounded, as we all know, in the Constitution. And as such, it is to the Constitution that we must look to determine the issues on which the capital budget has evidently floundered. The injection of contingency and non-severability language that the Senate clearly intended to use to constrain the power of the executive branch. As this body well knows, the Alaska Constitution establishes an appropriation process that consists of four discrete steps. First, the governor is required to submit a budget to the legislature for consideration. Second, the legislature, as a bicameral body, has the power to pass appropriation bills. Third, the governor, by constitution, has line item veto authority over those appropriation items. And fourth, the legislature is empowered and has authority to override the governor's veto. This is the process that has been in place since statehood, and it is the foundation of the checks and balances that constrain the exercise of power between two co-equal branches of government. Sections, what are now sections 48 and 49, previously sections 36 and 37 of the capital budget as recently transmitted to the House, disrupts the established process and upsets that delicate balance of power set forth in the Alaska Constitution. The simple reality is that the contingency and non-severability provisions of sections 48 and 49 are unconstitutional, individually and collectively. To be sure, the power to appropriate money for a public is vested in the legislature, period. Nonetheless, the governor plays a very vital role in the appropriation process. The governor's authority to propose a budget and his power to strike or reduce appropriation items are significant and essential parts to this process. Attempts to disrupt this process violate the balance of power carefully weaved into that process. The line item veto power has been described by Professor Briffelt, who's a constitutional scholar quoted in two prior Alaska Supreme Court cases, as, quote, the coming together of three widespread state constitutional policies. First, the rejection of legislative log rolling. Second, the imposition of fiscal constraints on the legislature. And third, the strengthening of the governor's role in budgetary matters. Alaska's Constitutional Convention delegates intended to create a strong executive branch with the strong control over the purse strings of the state. The Constitution provides the governor this control in part by granting the governor the line item veto authority to strike or reduce individual items in an appropriation bill. It was both logical and prudent for the constitutional delegates to confer this power on the governor. Since the governor's position is uniquely different than that of the legislature, the governor has a statewide constituency as opposed to the legislatures who have discrete geographic constituencies. The governor's position, as such, he is obligated with the responsibility to review and evaluate appropriations on a statewide basis. Therefore, it is prudent to give the governor authority to strike or reduce individual appropriation items and to act as a constraint on excessive spending. Nonetheless, The Constitution makes it very clear. The final power and the final step in the appropriation process rests with this body. It is the power to override the veto. With this background in mind, I'd like to turn to the two contingencies contained in the current version of the capital budget. Section 48, which I refer to as the linkage clause, seeks to link together what is now approximately 20 appropriation items, consisting of approximately 105 separate and distinct projects, comprising an estimated $454 million in total spending. Section 48 requires the enactment of all or none of these projects without reduction. These linked appropriations constitute roughly 25% of the unrestricted general funds proposed to be expended in the Senate's budget or version of the capital budget. Section 48 is unconstitutional. It violates Article 2, Section 15 of the Constitution in that it deprives the governor of his clear authority to reduce or strike individual appropriation items. Think about it logically. If the legislature could link one appropriation item to another, or as in this case, approximately 20, or in future instances, all transportation projects or all construction projects, regardless of location, the legislature would effectively eliminate the governor's constitutional power to strike or reduce individual line items. The governor would have only two choices: reject all or accept all as a group. Allowing the linking of appropriations with such contingency language would eviscerate the line item veto authority vested in the governor by the Constitution and would enable the legislature by fiat to circumvent the governor's constitutional authority. Section 48 usurps the governor's line item veto power and upsets the checks and balances built into the appropriation process by our constitutional framers. The proponents of Section 48 argue that linking multiple appropriation items may or might be constitutional because the governor still retains his right to veto the entire package of bundled appropriations. This argument is wrong for three reasons. First, the plain language of the Constitution itself affords the governor the authority in two parts. It is the authority to strike or reduce appropriation items, not bundles of appropriation items. In other words, Section 48, by its plain language, violates Article 2, Section 15. It not only prohibits the striking of an item, it also eliminates the ability of the governor to exercise his constitutional right to reduce an item. Second, if the legislature could bundle appropriation items and require passage, as in this situation, of all or none, then the legislature has authority to log roll, which is to put together a Christmas tree of items and to say, we've got to take all of these, all or nothing. So, you know, log rolling is one of the basic principles upon which the line item veto is vested. You know, I think it's very interesting and worth comment to note that Alaska, the constitutional delegates, when they framed the Alaska Constitution, had the benefit of numerous other states, the mistakes of numerous other states. And what they did was to take the best. And that best included, as the delegates clearly articulated, a strong executive branch from the standpoint of the line item veto. Right? Many of the other states that do have the line item veto put it in after their original constitutions were formed because of situations where the legislature is usurping, not usurping, but excessively spending. And so it was the effort to constrain budgetary runaway budgets. And so they put that in after. Many of those states put put those constraints in after their constitution was first framed. Alaska was very different. Sir.
A question for you, Mr. Burns. Mm-hmm. How many of the 50 states use a three-quarter requirement for override?
I believe it's very few. I think I was remiss. I have with me Brian Bjornquist and Chris Pogue, both with the Department of Law, who and both of whom were very instrumental in responding and addressing the issues contained in the Senate version.
And the reason
if I can direct that to either one of those.
And the number is not nearly as important because I know it's a handful, and yet when the members of the Constitution met, they didn't choose what typically was in the states of a two-thirds override. They went for the strongest possible, and I don't know anyone that's more than a three-quarter. And so I wondered, is that a pretty good indication? It is to me. That they intended for the governor to the executive branch to exercise a great deal of authority over the budget.
Absolutely, and I don't know the specific numbers, but it is a very few number of states that have the three-quarter override, and it's interesting to note, and I think significant to note, that the three-quarter override necessary vote for an override relates to primarily to the appropriations issues, which indicate again. The strong desire of the constitutional framers to give the executive branch authority over appropriations, the budgetary process.
And the one instance in the 9 years I've been here, I'm going to head for 10 here when we come back, there's only been one time, I think, where we met to override a governor's veto. I think only one time that required a three-quarter vote. We made it by zero margin. And we overrode, I think, Governor Palin's rejection of $28.5 million of stimulus money based on the idea of the, get this right, the universal building code, I think, was the issue at stake. But the fact is, it was a very high hurdle, extremely high hurdle. And even though we managed to do it, I just found it almost impossible to think that we would be able to do the same thing again. So I'm going to agree with you that the framers specifically wanted the executive branch to have a strong authority.
And I think there's no question of that, particularly when you read some of the minutes from the Constitutional Convention. And I would note that as Representative Grunberg has prepared an excellent memo that there's significant concern in the latest version of the capital budget as relates to Section 49 in that essentially eliminates the ability of this body to exercise its judgment in the context of a veto override because it now ties one of the non-severability provisions says if this body does not. It basically says, as we will get to in a minute, if this body does not override the veto, then the entire provision is non-severable and all appropriations fail. So, I won't spend much time discussing that issue, as I think Representative Grunberg's no doubt going to comment on that, and his write-up, I thought, addresses it very adequately and appropriately. Third, as I noted...
Representative Grunberg wants to ask a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, either to the Attorney General or to Mr. Pogue, one of you said that Alaska was the only state that went to three quarters. Was that you or was that Mr. Pogue?
Yeah, it wasn't me, as I don't know the number.
You, Mr. Pogue, through the chair.
You have to put yourself on the record here for the secretary.
Answer your question.
Drag up a chair and...
Good morning, Hash Judiciary. Chris Pogue. I work for the Department of Law, and I obviously work for Mr. John Burns. I did have a conversation yesterday evening with Representative Grunberg. I apologize, through the chair. I read a law review article that discussed or analyzed the line item veto power, and it indicated that as of present, and that was a few years ago, there were 43 states that had adopted a line item veto. 42 of those states limit the line item veto to appropriation bills. So obviously all but one state says the line item veto is limited to appropriation bills. 34 of those states require a two-thirds override. This body has two-thirds override for immediate effective date clauses, mm-hmm. retroactive provisions, various provisions. So two-thirds is obviously a higher hurdle than a simple majority. Of the remaining states other than Alaska, they had a more diluted override, either a three-fifths or a simple majority. At the time that that article was created, Alaska, as far as I know, is the only state that has a three-quarter override. And I provided to the chair as well as to Representative Grunberg a copy of the minutes from day 49 and day 50. And they had a discussion, and they attempted to amend the three-quarter override to go back to a two-thirds vote. There was also discussion at that time about going to an override by each body instead of a joint session. And there was a very heated discussion, and it was concluded that amendment failed, that a three-quarter override was important, that the three-quarter override needed to happen in joint session, even though it would dilute to some extent the Senate's power because it only has 20 members. And the reason they did that is because they said very clearly, we wish for our executive branch to have a strong control of the purse strings. That's a quote that the Alaska Supreme Court picked up in the Knowles case. And it is clearly in the constitutional minutes. It's in there repeatedly. So it appears to the Department of Law that this provision in the Constitution is not just unique among the states, but it's a clear indication that our constitutional framers meant for the line item veto power to be a strong line item veto power, not a weak one, not a diluted one. There's cases throughout the country that talk about line item veto, but we have to remember that this is going to be framed in context of Alaska's Constitution. Alaska's Constitution is unique and has a very powerful line item veto.
Okay. I want to announce one thing that joining us, Representative Seaton is in the audience, and Representative Sadler is in the audience. And then let me take 1 second here. Okay. Please continue.
Just one follow-up.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Grunberg?
Just to follow up, Mr. Pogue, through the chair. Do you remember when that law review article was written so we could put it in some context? We could come back to that question. I'd just like to put that on the record so that we can date it.
I think Mr. Bjorkquist is indicating over my shoulder.
He must have a mirror.
It's 1993, and I brought a copy of it for Representative Grunberg. So
well, thank you. I'll get it later. I just wanted to put that on the record. But I found that remarkable that we're the only state that goes three quarters, and that is another factor, I think, that may distinguish what we're dealing with here if this ever gets litigated from some of these other states. It's hard to find cases on this kind of an issue.
Representative Keller has a question.
This is just more for helping me put it in context, but to me this whole debate about the constitutionality of the budget bill is a red herring, the debate is. And the reason I say that, everybody's fixated on this debate, you know, whether or not it's constitutional or not. The budget bill is not the place to test constitutionality. And as the debate goes on here, we're getting statements like, well, we need to pass this so we test who has the powers. And I'm thinking that by definition, using Article 2, Section 14, we are really disqualifying the whole debate, the issue. And that is the germane section. It says right in there, bills for appropriations shall be confined to appropriations. So, you know, to think we're using it as a test of powers it just seems like a real stretch to me. And if I were a judge, I mean, I'd never guess what another judge would do, and I don't have the background. I'm not an attorney. If I were the judge, I'd throw the thing out of court and never even hear it. I mean, it'd be crazy. I mean, as far as the question about the constitutionality and whether or not it has any significance. And I say that's kind of a comment more than anything else, but I would just like to ask you if you've considered Attorney General Burns that idea of the germaneness of this being part of the bill and whether or not it's even a valid concern.
Absolutely, and what you're referring to is Article 2, Section 13, talks about the confinement provisions, and as I will note, as I wrap up the presentation, that is another basis. There are really two bases upon which this, in potentially three, with the most recent language, which clearly in my mind, tends to eliminate the legislative or intrudes upon the legislative bodies authority under Article 2, Section 16 to override the veto process. But certainly the two that are most directly affected by 48 and 49 are the line item veto, Article 2, Section 15, and then the confinement provisions that are found in Article 2, Section 13.
If I could, one quick follow-up, just to put on the record, it seems to me that the appropriate way to address an issue like whether or not the governor is too powerful or not, and having been here with a number of governors, number of AGs, I have often been very frustrated with the power of the governor and the power of the AG, but the appropriate way to address that is with statute. A germane topic, one topic, you know, where there'd be a collaborative process going through, maybe resulting in a constitutional amendment resolution or something like that. And I mean, it's a comment, not a question, but I would like, you know, if you could rubber stamp it for the record, it helps me understand the context anyway.
Well, certainly the process by which you can affect the what is in the Constitution and the authority that is vested in the executive branch in the Constitution is through a constitutional amendment. That is the appropriate process. It is not to effectively through fiat amend the Constitution through what is being attempted to do in this situation through 48 and 49, that contingency and non-severability language.
Yeah,
sir.
And I would agree we have a powerful executive branch, but the power of the purse is right here around this table. The governor cannot add any money to the budget. The governor can deliver an enormous budget to us, and we can simply make our own. So while the governor and the executive branch does have a significant input, it is only as accepted by the legislature. So with the power of the purse in our hands, to say the governor really is a powerful individual, we could reduce we can reject his entire budget and just write our own. So the power is really here. And I don't want to allow anyone to lose sight on that we have a big responsibility in the money that's spent. And every time we spend a dollar, we have to account for that dollar. And that's why we are essentially having some sort of an argument over the packaging of a bunch of energy projects in one place, is that we've lost. I think that helps us to lose our ability to account for the money that we're spending. But I'm not going to I know we have an opposing viewpoint, and I've agreed with the opposing viewpoint also in that I'm trying to analyze the best I can. I think the rest of us are too. See what it is that I don't know what path we're on even yet. If the Senate decides to just agree to leave this language out, do we just drop it and wait for it to surface again in another year? Or do we try to pursue some legal opinion? But I think this today may be the beginning of which direction that moves in, that we're going to have some people here that are energized to reach a conclusion. So I'm sorry for the interruption, but ask you to go ahead. I'm sorry, Representative Gruenberg.
I just was going to follow up on something that you said, Representative Keller, I thought you were going to say. What lawyers tend to talk about, and I think that we lawyers are thinking in these kinds of terms, and I see there are other lawyers scattered throughout the audience in the back there. We're going to hear from those guys anyway, thank you. And I hope. And that is the concept of judicial review, with the accent on judicial review. Since Marbury versus Madison, it's been established that the judiciary has the final say on constitutionality. But what is usually overlooked is something that's far more prevalent, and that's legislative review. They may have the final say, but the legislature has the first say, primary in the sense of first. Primary versus recency, that old. The concept of legislative review, I think, is even more important than judicial review, because so few cases actually overturn statutes. And the reason for that is because generally the legislatures do a pretty good job, with the advice of these attorney generals and our alleged legal counsel, in making sure that ideas that are of doubtful or certain unconstitutionality just don't get enacted. And occasionally there's the concept of executive review. When the legislature lets something go through, then the executive, by veto, often with the veto message, catches that as well. And so we really, in the legislature, and through this committee, which is the committee of primary jurisdiction over these issues, we are at the epicenter, not just in this case, but in so many cases, of being the very first to review for constitutionality. And I'd like to sort of have our folks keep that in mind, because that's one of the reasons this committee is so important, in my opinion.
Thank you.
And I, through the chair, and I thank Representative Grunberg that you very appropriately articulated that in the memorandum that you've provided to the full body, the concerns and the you know, the relationship with the checks and balances, and also the concerns that the legislature has in preserving its rights under Article 2, Section 16 in the veto override process. And the Constitution sets a clear process that, to follow regarding bills generally and appropriations in this situation, and to corrupt that process or to modify that process to force agreements that bootstrap things is you know, neither appropriate procedurally nor constitutionally permitted. And that's the big concern in this situation.
May I follow up on the ethics thing? Because I think we're generally somewhat familiar with what's going on here. It seems to me that in cases of this type, and I'm going to use the Legislative Council versus Knowles as a paradigm example, where it's the legislature versus the executive, then as a matter of logic, in almost every such case, there'll be a conflict of interest either in the lawyers for the executive branch or in the lawyers for the legislative branch. The question one or the other has to answer is, whom do I represent? Do I represent the people, or do I represent the alliance? And I wasn't going to necessarily pursue that, and I don't know if either you or Mr. Gardner want to comment on that. But we talk, and we've talked here in questioning you on your confirmation hearing, of how you were handling that. Mr. Gardner didn't come to us for a confirmation hearing, so we've never heard from him. But this is maybe one of the few opportunities where we have both of you in the same room, and you both have essentially the same quandary. You may be on one side in one issue and on the other side in another issue, but it's ever present. If it's not in the forefront, it's in the background. And I think it's an essential question from both our point of view and the public's.
Thank you.
And through the chair, and I have no reservation or hesitation in answering that question. My responsibility, as I told the this committee through the confirmation process, is first and foremost to uphold the Constitution. That's what this issue is all about, right? I am not here as a representative of the governor, although clearly I am in the capacity as an appointed attorney general. My first and foremost responsibility, as is clear in the statutes, is to uphold the Constitution and the statutes of this great state. And that's what I am doing, and that's the basis of my presentation today, and I think clearly what is at issue is the constitutionality of sections 48 and 49. So at this time I'd like to I think I've covered sufficiently section 48. I'd like to spend a bit of time on section 49, which is what we call the non-severability or the inseverability provision, depending on who's the grammarian. I've heard it referred to both ways. Section 49 exacerbates the constitutional violation, which we talked about, of the linking, because it asks a court to empower the legislature to do indirectly what the legislature itself cannot do directly. It seeks to achieve through the back door, which it cannot, the legislature cannot achieve through the front door. It effectively says, if what we are proposing through the contingency is invalid, then court, okay, invalid because we are usurping or violating the constitutional provisions, then court, you know, give us that power by invalidating the entirety of the appropriation. It's the poison pill. And so although there are a number of cases and there are some very interesting legal treatises that spend a great deal of time discussing non-severability and the deference provided to a legislature in the context of non-severability, what those cases, certainly the cases as relate to the federal context are inappropriate because the federal executive does not have the authority of line item veto. But with regards to state cases where severability has been or non-severability has been evaluated, the distinction is that the non-severability provision is being applied to eclipse or usurp another body's authority, that is unconstitutional. And so that's precisely what is being sought to be achieved here. And that's what makes this non-severability provision problematic and unconstitutional. Because what it is effectively doing, to reiterate, is to provide the legislature the ability to do indirectly what it clearly cannot do directly. Sir.
I think it's important that there are people on the other side of that camera that are listening, and the term severability isn't enough of a term that's commonly used. And in my understanding, if I get it, I'll try to be a lawyer here. If you have a bill and any part of the bill is deemed as unconstitutional, with severability, you can sever that part and the remainder remains legal. That's severability. Well, we've tossed around non-severability and we've tossed around the word severability with regards to part two of the contingency language. And I think members of the public who are listening could easily say, have no idea, and turn us off. Because we've essentially lost them. So the term severability, am I correct, simply says if this part's unconstitutional, all the rest remains in effect, and we just strike this. But then non-severability means if this part's unconstitutional, the whole thing is unconstitutional. Which brings to mind, if you want a good example, is the PAPACA, Patient Protection and Affordable Health Care, or Obamacare, where the judge said, because one part of the bill was unconstitutional, the entire bill falls because they did not have a severability clause in the bill. So that's where it is the most important that I've heard. But by knowing that, it applies to here also, that we're talking about, unfortunately, non-severability. So what we're saying is the other parts of the bill don't remain in force. The whole thing falls apart. Am I correct?
Absolutely. And I would simply note that Alaska, this legislature has passed a statute that presumes severability, that actually says to the extent that there's a portion of a bill that's invalid, and that invalid provision is presumed to be severed from the remainder of the bill, because after all, the legislature would not want to enact something that was invalid. And so as long as the key, though, is the ability to sever something and the remainder to remain in effect. So in the PAPACA situation, what Judge Vinson, the Florida judge, found in that is, although there were a myriad of different provisions, the requirement of mandatory health care, the purchase of mandatory health care, was so intricately intertwined with the entirety of that bill that you couldn't sever it, okay? That you couldn't give effect to the remainder. And because the legislature, you know, the federal legislature in that situation, had not included a severability provision, the court found that the court was not able to tease them apart, and so the entirety was held to be invalid because of the one unconstitutional provision. And that, you know, that flows very nicely into the context of what we are seeking to achieve here. What the Senate through Section 49 has sought to do is to infuse everything and say that you can't pull them apart. But when you simply look at the provisions that are found in Section 4, there is no way to construe them as all intricately intertwined so that you can't tease any apart. What the premise on which the Senate has sought to achieve this is to say under 115 of the statute, and specifically it's 4499.115, that deals with an energy policy, and since these are all energy related, even though you have them throughout various geographic areas and not interconnected, that somehow they all are intertwined as energy and you can't pull one apart without losing all. But all you need to do is look at the individual items to recognize that that logic doesn't flow in the context of a non-severability provision. And so as such, it's not intricately intertwined to the degree that you cannot logically separate. And so, that's one issue. And the second and most significant, and I think, again, deferring to Representative Grunberg's write-up when he discusses the interplay between two cases, the Alive case, which is an Alaska case, A-L-I-V-E, and the Brown case, which is a Kentucky case. Both of those cases talk about just that. You can't achieve an unconstitutional objective through a judicial fiat. The legislature can't say, hey, if we can't do it, court, we want you to do it for us. And so the court, even though there's generally a deference given to the legislature in the context of its drafting of legislation, and particularly in the context of a non-severability, because that's a clear indication that the legislature has thought about it, what the judiciary is likely or very unlikely to do is to give such deference so as to allow a legislative body to usurp or eclipse, in this case, what a power that is clearly conferred upon the executive branch.
I look at it as just a second bite at the apple.
Exactly. Okay, to trying to achieve indirectly.
Chris is smiling. Okay. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. An issue that had come up in the back of my mind as I was considering this, and it never got to the point where I mentioned it to anybody, none of you folks and not Mr. Gardner either. If a court were to have the bill as is in front of it and were to strike down the clauses, I'm going to say the twin clauses here, would it necessarily... And let me give you the hypothetical so people can see. The bill passes, the governor vetoes something in Section 4. It's irrelevant what. So we have a line item veto that's attempted. Just let's say one item for the purpose of discussion, for ease. A court then rules and finds these clauses, these sections, unconstitutional. Would it necessarily sustain the line item veto, or might it remand the case without doing any more than a declaration of unconstitutionality, basically so the legislature could determine whether to allow the line item veto or redo the entire bill? In other words, not make the final decision on whether the line item veto would stand, because it seems to me there are two different issues. One issue, the first issue in time, is whether the clauses are unconstitutional. And the second issue is what result flows from that. I wasn't entirely sure that necessarily the court would reach the second issue. But it might basically say, we are at this point simply determining that these clauses are unconstitutional, and what to do about it is up to the legislature. Has anybody considered whether that is a likely outcome?
To the chair, Representative Grunberg, I hesitate to ever presuppose what a what a court would do. If I could do that, I would have been a very wealthy man. But in the context of this situation, obviously the court could I think, do either. My presumption, though, is that the court's going to analyze this in two parts. They're first going to look at Section 48, the contingency language. And then they're going to presumably find, for the reasons just articulated, that provision in and of itself is unconstitutional. And so that provision is stripped from the appropriation because it's an unconstitutional infringement. Then the second part is that the court's going to look at the poison pill, the non-severability provision. And courts typically view provisions in the context of severable, non-severable. And the question being, can that non-severability provision be essentially severed from the remainder of the bill and keep the bill effectively intact? My expectation under the circumstances of this case would be that the court would do just that. They would look at it, find that 48 unconstitutional, see the application of 49 as trying to achieve that unconstitutional provision, strip 49 out or sever 49, from the remainder of the bill, and the bill would proceed, or the appropriation bill would proceed forward with whatever line item vetoes. That, you know, that's certainly a heck of a risk, because what it does, and as I'll discuss in a minute, you know, there are the practical implications of this, of this posturing, and the concern of going to court. Is the practical implications on these projects generally, because what you've indicated as a possible result is that the court simply puts everybody back to square one, is we have phenomenal delay in any of these in any of the projects.
Mr. Chair,
go ahead.
If the court were reasoning in that manner, Mr. Attorney General, I would agree. However, sometimes the courts reach that same result not on the basis of severability, but on a different legal basis, which is the basis of abstention and comity and refusal to interject itself, in this case, into a co-equal branch of government. They might say, And this is something I hadn't fully developed because I came to the same conclusion in my memo you did, but thinking it through further, and this is kind of like a tangled skein of yarn, it continues to lead us from one question to another. And this is a question that nobody's really addressed, whether even if the court concluded exactly as you've said, it might say that we're not going to direct a remedy in this case on the basis of comity and abstention, which I don't think there's any constitutional impediment to its doing, nothing in the bill that would prevent it from doing that. And there might be some good policy reasons for doing it. It might delay the thing. The result would have the unfortunate result potentially of delaying the projects past the construction season, but and that might be very persuasive to the court. But what I'm wondering is whether the court might employ comity, which is respect for the other branch of government, or abstention, which is kind of another way of saying the same thing, to reach the same result of tossing the ball back. And any comment?
Through the chair, Representative Greenberg, that always is a distinct possibility, and particularly in instances where there is a challenge to the powers of, theoretically, co-equal branches of government, and so that is certainly a potential and a significant risk in moving forward. My sense, though, is that given the context of 48 and 49, my hope, at least, is that the court would see this as so blatantly, under the circumstances, unconstitutional,
as to, you know, strip it out, you know, to sever it. And I think, you know, my sense of it in reading, having read the cases and the legal treatises, and most importantly, the history from the constitutional delegation as to the strong executive branch, the powers of the executive branch relative to the line item veto, the striking and reduction, those two items, the striking or reduction, that I think the court would find these provisions so blatantly unconstitutional as to sever it. Again, though, you know, I can't know in advance what the court would do.
Just a final word on that. I would hope that in the unfortunate possibility, remote though it may be, I hope that this thing ever got litigated, I would hope both sides would at least keep that in mind potentially to address the court, because otherwise the court could take a step without guidance of either counsel, and that's something that at least I just put a bug in your ear.
No, I would. I can assure you that from the Department's law's perspective, it would be something that would be aggressively articulated and presented to the court.
Just for the record, we've been joined by Representative Alan Dick. And Mr. Attorney General, let me ask you this question, which always some direction I usually try to go, and I'll take things to an extreme. If the court finds that 4849 are constitutional and we're going to live with them, is it possible for the legislature to do an entire capital budget in one line and say take it or leave it?
Well, you know, the point, the real concern is once you start down this path, where do you end? All right? Because you look at the capital budget, the primary components of that capital budget, transportation, for example, education, facilities. All of a sudden we start lumping together, you know, a school in Fairbanks or Anchorage cannot be built unless a school in Tuntutuliak or Imonic or someplace of that nature, or a road system, okay, even though they may at one point merge, that, you know, not being able to build one because you can't build the other four or five. And the point being, where do you stop? Where do you draw the line and say, okay, you know, enough is enough? There's an adage in a bankruptcy case, and I can't remember the site, but it's humorous, but very apropos to many situations in life, that pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered. Okay, and it was in the context of overreaching and pre-funding retirement plans. And so the court typically says that those retirement plans are exempt, but somebody just loaded it with millions of dollars, and the court said, hey, you know, there's a clear intent there to violate, you know, what the provisions are. But it's analogous to this sort of situation, because where do you draw the line? So do we now have just five items, five appropriations, and you know, it's all or nothing?
Well, excuse me, but in retirement plans, I mean, they may say that you must have in reserves 89% of your outstanding obligations, or 81%, or 110%. So there are some sideboards on retirement plans, except for Social Security, of course, which my understanding is none of the money is available. It's all been borrowed away and needs to be repaid. I'm not sure if the obligation for the federal government to repay it is sufficient to guarantee the viability of the plan for 10 years out or 20 years out. But you brought up the idea of a retirement plan. I'm not able to make the connection between the severability clause, the contingency clause, and a retirement plan. No,
the only point being that in the context of the case involving the retirement is typically those funds are not available to be attached. And in that particular situation, somebody had just loaded the retirement so heavily as to really eclipse what the purpose of that exemption has been. And the same point being here, the analogous point,
here is that where do you draw the line? If you're going to allow 105 items to be bundled together, why not 250? Why not the entire bill? That's the point, is that where do you draw the line? The Constitution makes it very clear under in Article 13, which we'll get to in a moment, the confinement provision that Representative Keller had mentioned, that there has to be a nexus. It's got to be a connection between the purpose and the appropriation. And, you know, otherwise you just bundle everything together as a Christmas tree. And again, as emphasized early on in the constitutional parameters of the drafters, the whole purpose of providing the executive branch strong authority in the context of the line item veto was to eliminate just that issue, the log rolling, the bundling together and trying to eclipse things, and to eliminate that ability to evaluate and to, you know, constrain excessive spending.
We've been at this almost an hour. Do you kind of, and I know Ms. Gardner's going to want to come up here. We may spend another hour on him, which is fine. And then for the final hour, that'll really be our opportunity to ask as many questions as we have, including some questions from our representatives in the audience who've joined us. So
if you don't
go ahead,
mind,
no, I don't want you to. I don't want you to speak any less than your plan, but that's the plan of the day.
Let me just address specifically the concerns and comments of Representative Keller relative to the confinement provision, because what we've been talking about is Article 2, Section 15, which is the line item veto. But these provisions of 48 and 49 are also unconstitutional relative, certainly the 48 relative to Article 2, Section 13. Appropriation bills, as reflected in Article 2, Section 13, must be confined to appropriations. According to the Alaska Supreme Court, the confinement clause prevents the legislature from enacting substantive policy outside of the public eye. In interpreting the confinement clause, the Alaska Supreme Court adopted a five-part assessment, which is commonly referred to as the Hammond test, which was subsequently articulated in the Knowles case that, again, Representative Grunberg spent some time talking about in his memo. Succinctly stated, the contingency provision and the intent language inserted by the Senate in Senate Bill 46 fail that Hammond test for a number of reasons. First, the Alaska Statute 4499.115, which is the state energy policy and which is the premise upon which the bundling or the linkage was set up in the first place, certainly from my understanding of the comments made by the Senate, that was the premise of this bundling. It's important to note when you read 115 that 115 does not mandate that an energy policy be implemented by linking energy projects or appropriation. Instead, 115 encourages state agencies to communicate with communities to figure out what they need. And so, and then to identify and develop cost-effective sources of energy. It also violates the Hammond test because the linking of appropriations is not provided for in 115, and doing so in this appropriation bill effectively amends existing law and is beyond the minimum necessary, is one of the tests in Hammond, to explain how money is to be spent. Third, because linking appropriations is a direct attempt to control how monies are spent on energy projects, it attempts to administer the program of expenditures, which again is in violation of the Hammond test. And finally, linking appropriations that bear no direct relationship to one another is not a condition, again, one of the Hammond tests, a condition germane to the purpose of the appropriation. So those are the concerns relative to the confinement. And again, setting aside all the legal machinations that we've talked about, the practical implications of Senate, sections 48 and 49 also bear some discussion and comment, because what by putting 48 and 49 in there, essentially anybody has the right to and standing to challenge those provisions. The legislature, particularly in light of 49B, would have the authority. Each an individual legislator would have that ability because it's taking away your prerogative, your right in the veto override. But, you know, on top of that, anybody who is upset or perturbed by the language and the attempt to usurp an executive branch's control could affect whether they wanted to or opposed to a project or otherwise, could effectively disrupt and challenge through a judicial process the validity of that. And the result of that is that there's a cloud over these projects. And so, you know, with that cloud over the project, there's a risk that the projects, even the projects that are approved, may not be able to receive the funding that's been appropriated. Likewise, financing, obtaining the financing through either a financier or a bonding agency may be difficult in light of the cloud that hangs over these projects. And most importantly, the desire to move the projects forward so that we can stimulate the Alaska economy and get these projects, those appropriate projects, moving forward and completed without having to wait for a final determination by a court.
Just a minute, Representative Grunberg. Are you on this same point? Okay, Representative Grunberg.
You know, I did not mention and have not really mentioned the argument on the confinement clause. And the reason is because I didn't think it was necessary, and I tend to disagree with you on that. The language, the only sentence in Article 2, Section 13 that applies is, quote, bills for appropriations shall be confined to appropriations, unquote. And it seems to me that Senate Bill 46 is confined to appropriations. It doesn't say one appropriation must have a relation to another. It's just that they must all be appropriations. The only things that are arguably not appropriations that are relevant here are sections 48A and 49. And it seems to me they are instructions on how these appropriations shall be treated by a potential vetoing authority on the one hand and a potential court on the other. So they're necessary, at least in the drafters' opinions, to effectuate what the legislature wishes to do with respect to those appropriations. And that seems to me the end of the matter, regardless of whether a road and mnemonics related to one in Kluwak.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, you are obviously correct in that Section 13 does not articulate anything beyond what you just quoted. Bills for appropriations shall be confined to appropriations. However, as you noted earlier, the final determiner of constitutional issues is, in this case, the Alaska Supreme Court. And the Alaska Supreme Court, in two instances, Hammond and Knowles, has clearly articulated what is an appropriation and what is an item. And it has listed those five criteria that I listed five criteria, and some of which the minimum necessary germaneness, those sorts of things. And so notwithstanding what the Constitution says, when you evaluate these appropriations in the context of that litmus test of five criteria, that's the balancing. Because in theory, right, you can use language that simply says this is an appropriation and it's all necessary. And then using the logic appropriation and appropriation, anything that falls within it would be appropriate under the confinement. And the Alaska judiciary, the Supreme Court has said, it goes way beyond that. You have to look at the content of what is in the appropriation to make certain that it is truly an appropriation.
So what you're really saying, if I may through the chair, is not that the language on its face is necessarily unconstitutional, but that applying it in certain cases may violate the confinement concept. I really would have to give that some
No, I would agree with that assessment, and I would turn it over briefly to Brian Bjornquist with the Department of Law, as he's intimately familiar with the confinement clause.
Let me interject with one question. Bills for appropriations, plural, shall be confined to appropriations, plural. Is that a key in this phrase that the second word appropriation, plural, appropriations, really tends to tell me that in wordsmithing, they're referring to more than one? Is that a misinterpretation on my part, or is there some other explanation?
First, for the record, I am Brian Bjorkus. I'm a senior assistant attorney general in the Department of Law. Mr. Chair, you're correct in reading that bills for appropriation are limited to appropriations. There can be multiple appropriations in an appropriation bill. Mm-hmm. Typically, there are. The appropriation bills are not subject to a single subject. You can have appropriations for multiple subjects, multiple types of issues, and as long as the bill is limited to appropriations, it's constitutional. That's what the provision is intended to provide for. The distinction is that an appropriation bill is limited to appropriations. It can't include substantive law. An appropriation is defined to be an item designated for a specific purpose with a funding source. That's basically what an appropriation is. And as long as the bill is limited to focusing on that, the appropriations, it's acceptable. Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, the difficulty or where the confinement clause is violated in this bill is the linkage of various appropriations to each other. The Hammond test needs to be applied individually on an item-by-item basis because each item is an appropriation. If you have an appropriation for one project, you apply the Hammond test to the linkage to every other project that is attempted to be linked in this bill, and an appropriation for a transmission line on the Kenai Peninsula, what connection is there to an appropriation for a hydro project in western Alaska or southeast? There is none. The language goes beyond what's necessary to identify what the money is intended to be spent for in that the language with the appropriation item itself identifies the sum of money, the purpose for which it's directed, and the source of money it's directed towards, in the first instance, the intertie, and there's no connection to the others. I think it's also instructive to just look at the intent language in Section 4 of the current version of SB 46, in which the intent language on page 98, lines 6 through 12. It begins by describing the state energy policy, and then on line 10, it switches to, therefore, the legislature intends that the package of appropriations and projects listed below are all necessary to achieve a statewide balance in addressing the state's diverse energy needs. I would submit to you that sentence is what is creating substantive law. That sentence is what is creating a new energy program or a new energy policy. The linkage of all of these appropriations together into something that is to achieve a statewide balance in addressing the state's diverse energy needs.
Mr. Chair, may I?
Hold on. You let him finish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's this connection of all of these projects that creates the problem. And look at it from the standpoint of what criteria was used to pick these particular projects and these particular communities that are now part of the what is designated to be necessary for achieving a statewide balance. What criteria why are other projects and communities not included in this mix of appropriations? This linkage of this mix of appropriations is a policy programmatic decision being made by the legislature. And when you apply the Hammond factors to that, one, it's if it's intended to be a substantive law, or the energy program itself is substantive law linking them, this amends or changes what is in 4499.115. That policy focuses on helping individual communities. There is nothing about a statewide balance. When you look at the legislature administering a program of expenditures, this linkage of these is linking all of these, and it's administering all of this energy program, the linkage of these, all of these programs or projects and appropriations together. There's also the minimum necessary language necessary for an appropriation. If you look at an individual item that identifies, again, an appropriation as sum of money designated for a specific purpose with a funding source, each of the individual items that are listed identifies what the money, the amount of the money, what the purpose of the appropriation is, what the specific purpose is, and the source of money. So each on its own is an item, and it's an appropriation. And looking at, for example, the first one, Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, coal to liquids, that stands on its own. That language there is the minimum necessary to affect this appropriation. You go to the next item down, and that language is superfluous to the first appropriation. It's beyond the minimum necessary language necessary for that particular appropriation. And so it violates the minimum necessary test of the Hammond test as well. And I have temporarily forgotten one of the final tests, but applying in a practical sense, the linkage of all these projects, that's where the problem is with the confinement clause.
Mr. Chair.
Hold on. And I'll get to you next. I have personally a lot of trouble with a statement that says to achieve a balance. There are 60 of us here. There are 60 different balances. And then the word all has been repeated over and over and over, at least five times sometimes in the same paragraph, to affect all of the districts and all of the population. So when I read a statement that where the statement itself is strongly subject to an interpretation, then I don't know if that comes under illegal or irresponsible. But I can't accept a statement like that as a justification for reaching a conclusion. And so I dismissed the conclusion because the justification for it was impossible to ascertain as to whether or not it was reasonable or unreasonable. It was unreasonable. There is no such thing as everybody's going to agree on what the proper balance is. So when you put 40 projects together, to achieve a balance for all the citizens is totally impossible for me to accept, because there's no way we could get an agreement on what that would be. So is that somehow related to the legality or non-legality of that section?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's directly related to what I was trying to describe for the confinement clause, in that when you look at the energy policy, it says that the policy is to identify, assist with the development of the most cost-effective long-term source of energy for each community statewide. And then the next one, this bill selects all of the projects that are necessary for a statewide balance. That selection is not being done by the statute. There's no criteria in the statute that developed the state energy policy that identifies each and every one of these as being what affects a statewide balance, as you say. That's why this is substantive law. That provision talking about linking for a statewide balance is a substantive decision. It's not an appropriation on an individual, item-by-item basis. I agree with your assessment.
And Representative Seaton and I, and he brought it up, we're talking about the difference between an appropriation and an allocation. And then when I talked to Mr. Pogue, the appropriation is a given amount of money for four projects, five projects, 500 projects, and then the allocation is for each one. But the allocations can be swapped. let's do it all on projects, odd number projects, and eliminate all the even numbered projects. So that's a possibility.
There are statutory provisions that allow for moving of money, Mr. Chair, through the chair, or to the chair. There are statutory provisions that allow for moving of money between allocations of an appropriation under the Fiscal Procedures Act, I believe. Mr. Pogue is more conversant in that if you want more detail.
And there's an excellent reference in this array of materials talking about an item. And they talked about an item can be any one of the following. $4 million for roads in Anchorage. It's an item. $4 million for roads X, Y, and Z in Anchorage. $1 million, or alternatively, excuse me, $1 million for road X, $1 million for road Y, and $2 million for road Z. So that adds, it's almost like making a pie. Do you want to eat the whole thing or just a slice? And then can we make a bigger slice or a smaller slice and not eat part of it? And put the whole thing in offering the pie to one person. That, to me, was a very clear example of the difficulty we have with an item. But those four are appropriations. But I notice right here in the documents that was discussed yesterday, the projects are now listed as appropriations. Even before we got here, heard that yesterday, that I thought that, I'm going to say threw a monkey wrench into it, but it certainly complicated our ability here to discuss what we're trying to discuss here is. But I'm going to get back to what the Attorney General said. We're interested in the Constitution, and that really is the key. But the rest of this, as far as is it constitutional to even move in those other directions, and I'd also like to get to defining what an item is. But was Ms. Gardner that actually wrote to Senator French describing what an item was, and I thought that description was clear also. So, sorry, but we have some other people that wanted to make some comments, but I'll let you finish.
Just one comment on Mr. Chair. You described several different ways that the legislature could choose to make an appropriation, mm-hmm. and that is within the legislature's mm-hmm. prerogative as to how to appropriate money, whether combining and with allocations or otherwise, and there's consequences for each one. But the one point that I'd like to make is that with each of those options, the governor under the Constitution has line item veto power. And tying the two constitutional issues together, the one of the issues with the confinement clause and why this is a difficulty is you're linking projects together. And when you go over to the line item veto, one of the historical purposes that the Supreme Court found for that was to prevent log rolling. That's what's going on in Section 4 with the other sections combining and linking all of these together. It's log rolling. And to the extent that that is part of a energy plan, it's an energy plan that's being created in this document itself, and that's substantive law.
Could the governor line item veto an allocation, or does he have to line item veto the appropriation?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that the governor has line item veto over an appropriation, and there are consequences to line item vetoing appropriation with the allocations underneath.
Okay. So we had some questions from the committee here. Representative Grunberg, I think, wanted to ask a question.
Yes. Your question. I want to focus on your presentation. It seems to me, and I'm still not convinced of the confinement issue, at least as you presented it. The only thing, let's start with the Constitution, the text of the Constitution. The only provision that's relevant is the sentence, the single sentence in Article 2, Section 13. Bills for appropriations shall be confined to appropriations. It doesn't say you can or cannot tie appropriations together. It looks at the entire bill, does it not? And as long as the entire bill deals solely with appropriations, the clear text would seem to sustain it. I understand the Hammond test, but I just don't see how this applies in this particular case, because the way the text is written, it only looks at the bill as a whole, and as long as the bill is an appropriation bill, mm-hmm. and it doesn't contain other things, I don't think this sentence is violated. And I would, and I realize I'm kind of doing a soliloquy here, but I think it's necessary so you can see my reasoning. I don't think we would be here on the confinement issue if we didn't have sections 48A and 49. If it really were a confinement issue, then you would be here, and let's say that those clauses were not in, and you were to say that because of this intent language or whatever, the confinement clause is violated. I think that's an awfully weak read to lean on. The thing that we're concerned about is the effect of these two clauses. And what your argument focused on was a different part of the bill, which is the language in the intent language on page 98. And that is simply an expression of legislative intent. It is not binding any more than a policy statement in the permanent law is binding. It's simply a general, it's like a resolution in the sense that it gives the sense of the legislature of why they're doing this. But in a constitutional sense, I'm not aware of any authority that says that carries any weight whatsoever. And as I say, the underpinning of my response to you is I don't think we'd be sitting here having this conversation at all were it not for 48A and 49. And that being the case, and your argument doesn't deal with those, and this text of the Constitution simply, in my opinion, looks at the bill as a whole, I think it's a weak read. And the reason I'm saying this is because in some senses, if this ever went to court in this or any other case, what we're talking about today may, and you'll be one of the lawyers hopefully involved in this thing, be something you'll be thinking about. I wouldn't want to take that issue on a contingency fee.
through the chair,
it probably won't be offered.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I did not intend my comments to be focused solely on the intent language of Section 4, but I believe the intent language of Section 4 is instructive as to how a court will interpret Section 48A, which links all of these projects together. The two have to be read in combination with each other. And then also Section 49, all three have to be read in combination to understand what is happening with the bill as a whole, the linkage of projects together. I would also respectfully disagree with the assessment that the Hammond test is not instructive as to the Constitution, because the Alaska Supreme Court has identified it as the test for determining the confinement clause and when it's violated or not. And so our Alaska Supreme Court has given instruction that's the test to use to interpret the constitutional confinement clause.
Okay. And Ms. Burns, have you concluded your presentation?
I have. Thank you very much.
Okay. We are right at the halfway mark. Representative Lynn?
Yes. Before you leave, do you have a copy available for your initial presentation? I tried to take notes on it. I thought it was very good.
I'd be happy to provide a copy to the
to all of us. Right. Thank you very much.
I'll have to proof it for spelling, though, if you don't mind.
I'll do that.
Yeah. That's why we have the revisers.
Thank you.
Don't go away yet, Representative Pruitt.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Maybe a quick question. Can you help me? One of the questions that I have would relate to the opinion that I feel that the Senate may be basing some of their discussion off of, and that is the opinion that the legislature has to operate as if any act that we put forth is automatically constitutional, mm-hmm. and that it lies right. upon people that are opposed to certain aspects of what we may pass out of here to prove that it's unconstitutional. Can you speak to that for me and help me understand if that truly is the situation of the case?
Sure. It's what we commonly refer to as a rebuttable presumption. The presumption is that this body will do things that are constitutional. But just because you pass something doesn't mean that it is constitutional. And so once, for the reasons that we simply articulated here relative to 48 and 49, the fact that you, if this language goes through unaltered, the fact that you passed it does not mean that it meets the litmus test of constitutionality. The presumption is that it is, and so then the court looks to whether or not truly is constitutional. And for the reasons that we've articulated, I think that presumption is rebutted very quickly.
So it is constitutional until a court says it isn't.
Well, the court is the final determiner of it. I mean, just because you do something does not, I mean, if you look at it in the context of what it is, how the premises upon which it was first articulated, which I understand was the concern for a retaliatory veto, which has been, publicly, clarified numerous times that type of a veto will not be exercised. That's the premise upon which it was in theory originally implemented. It's very easy to understand that it's the desire was to usurp or restrict the powers of the governor, the executive powers as found in Article 2, Section 15. So just because you do it, I'd be reluctant to say that you ought to be able to skip out of here thinking anything you guys do is going to pass muster until it's challenged in court. I mean, we all have the obligation when we took the oath of office to uphold the Constitution, and I think Representative Grunberg articulated it very well when he said we have to in large measure police ourselves. You've got legislative oversight, you've got executive oversight, and you've got judicial oversight. And the hope and the desire is that this legislative body, when the legislative body sits back and looks at this language, not only legally but practically, the legislative body will find that it's inappropriate and will strip it from the bill.
But I have to tell you, I have a strong appreciation for what happened on the Senate side, and use the term retaliatory veto. If they were to give up the language that protects them, and the retaliatory veto were to be exercised anyway, they have no recourse except to get a three-quarter override, which we have already discussed is an enormously high bar.
Right.
So when the threat is made, and then you go, well, I didn't mean it, but I am going to be in sole possession of the ability to do it anyway, then that tells us that the other side is protecting themselves by putting this language in there and saying, this is too important to allow you to exercise what you've already threatened to do. So that's when I take the other side and say, I understand why they're doing what they're doing.
Well, there is I have not seen any language that clearly indicated that there would be any retaliatory vetoing. But clearly, two wrongs never make a right. And so, the governor has an obligation under Article 2, Section 15, that he shall return any vetoed bill with a statement of his objection to the House of Origin. And so the governor must explain the basis upon which he, in this situation, were to exercise a veto. Right? That, in turn, empowers the legislature with the ability to override that veto. Now, as you, Mr. Chairman, pointed out, the congressional delegates, when they evaluated the three-quarter requirement, there was some significant debate about it, and they clearly said, we know it's a constraint on the legislative body, but that's what we want. We want a checks and balances. We want the power to constrain excessive spending within the executive branch, subject to that burden of three quarters vote on a veto override. So there clearly is a risk, right? But our constitutional delegation, I think, considered that risk and said that in the context of the public arena, where a governor must explain and justify the decision upon which he or she makes in vetoing, that serves as an appropriate checks and balances as well. That requirement to articulate the basis of the objection, coupled with the ability, the authority and power of this body to override a veto, okay, is the appropriate checks and balance.
So the governor comes back and says, part of the capital budget includes a heat pump for a boathouse at $150,000, which I believe is in there, and says, that's a lot of money for a heat pump and a boathouse, so I'm going to veto that one. Is that sufficient as an explanation? It was pretty expensive for what we got.
I think that might be a justified justification of a veto. I'm not certain as to the extent of the actual language that's necessary, but what you've described is a concern of excessive spending on an item for which you're not receiving sufficient value. And the governor has an obligation, as does this body, to ensure that expenditures are in the best interest of the public. And so to the extent that you're paying $150,000 for a heat pump, that might far exceed what might otherwise be found in the
$20,000.
I would certainly hope that the due valuation of those types of issues would be given, and that would be sufficient justification in my mind.
All right. And I've been asked if we could take a 5-minute. I'm sorry. Before we do, Representative Keller.
And I think Representative Thompson.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Burns, for being here. Change the direction a little bit. I wanted to have you delve into a little bit more of what you did when the working draft had it as Section 3637, and now it's 4849, that it says that if the governor vetoes, but then in the next section, if one goes away, they all go away. How does that work with what you had to say about a third-party litigant that might be an objection to a hydroelectric project and files it in court? My understanding is that would stop all of the projects, and if the court found that that was not something that should go forward and rejects it, then everything goes away just because of a third-party litigant?
That's the potential concern, and I think it's more than potential. It's a real concern that anybody can challenge the unconstitutionality of a provision, right? Anybody would have standing. And so in theory, those who may, let's just use a project, the Susitna Hydro project, okay, likely to be a project that's going to require a lot of, significant an environmental impact statement. There will be a number of people who would be opposed to that project, all right? And so somebody opposed to a project would have the ability to challenge that project indirectly by challenging the unconstitutionality of what is now Section 48. Likewise, under 49, Representative Grudenberg, I think, very pointedly discussed in the memorandum that he provided to this body, any one of the legislators whose ability to exercise a judgment in a veto override has now been eclipsed under 49B would also be entitled to challenge it and would have standing to do so. And so what the practical implications of this is that while this may be a wonderful theoretical and academic issue, there are significant implications in reality as to these projects, and that's a significant concern.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Representative Keller.
Just a historical fact for context to those listening. From my perspective, as we got into this and first saw the language in the Senate bill, the decision that the House to stand firm and say no had nothing to do so much with the constitutional question so much as it did a policy question. We looked at this. We didn't want you know, we didn't know, you know, exactly what was the good projects and what were the bad projects. So we said, no, we're not going to buy into that. It was after the fact that we thought, oh, we need to define what it is here, get our legal services and Department of Law involved and everything. And the reason I guess I point that out is that it's a policy question first here, you know, and it's very good. And this goes back a little bit to your comment about the legislative review and the judicial review. And you also both made a statement that the judicial review or the Supreme Court is the final say. That's true if you've been through law school. It's true if you're talking a specific law. It's not true if you're talking about the sovereignty. And I'm sure you both agree with me. I'm pretty sure, anyway. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about the sovereignty of what is actually in the Constitution, you're talking about the people of the state of Alaska. And that's not high and mighty or even theoretical, because we have, you know, the initiative process. And they have changed, you know, the people of Alaska have changed. And they can change the Constitution before or after, you know, the question, you know, based on...
Not by initiative. We can't amend the Constitution.
You're right. I misspoke. It takes two-thirds of the majority. But we're representing the people of the state of Alaska, and we put the resolution through and get the... There's a process, there's a point, that has been used to amend the Constitution, and the sovereignty in that question lies with the people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, forgive me, but that's just a context, you know, because I know that some of my constituents are listening, and they would bristle at the fact that when they say that the Supreme Court is the final say, because, you know, in the terms of sovereignty, I think it goes beyond that.
Can it wait, or you want to make that
I just
comment?
Just very briefly, because I think this is going to be a point that will be a difference between you and Mr. Gardner, if Mr. Gardner is going to say what we've talked about. A question, and I'm looking at this not so much today from the point of view of this bill. I suspect and I hope that this bill will deal with this and it won't go to court. But the thing I'm really concerned about is the precedent. And that's the slippery slope argument that we've talked about, and we all know what we're talking about here. Mr. Gardner, you can nod or shake your head if I'm going to misstate what I think you're going to say. But what he and we've talked about, the question is going to be, on a smaller scale, whether a clause or two clauses like this would be constitutionally permissible. Let us say, for the example of a dam and an intertie, some things that are directly related, whether a small clause would be permissible that linked, and I'm going to say appropriately, a dam and an intertie or two roads or whatever you want, a rail and a spur. From a point of view of practicality, that may have much to recommend it, mm-hmm, in a very practical sense. From the point of view of the Constitution and the analysis in the alive voluntary case. And folks, all these cases are in your folder, and you might want to look at that case, because the difference between the majority and the dissent was on exactly this point. The majority, by a 3-2 vote in that case, said, even if you want, and I'm going to analogize it to this, if you want to tie two things together, you cannot impinge the constitutional right of the governor to sever. It's not a question of the benefit, policy-wise. It's a question of whether the legislature itself can do it by tying it together in the clause, or whether the executive would have to do it and make the decision of whether to tie them together. And my question to you, and I'll probably ask the exact opposite question to the folks from Ledge Legal, Mr. Burns, General Burns, do you believe that the Constitution would permit even a mini tie together clause?
Yeah. I'm a bit reluctant to talk in hypotheticals or theoretical situations, but I believe that there may be situations where you can posit a very close nexus, and that's the meeting the Hammond requirements, a very close nexus and connectivity that a linkage makes perfect sense. All right, you know, again though, what you're balancing the on the one hand the confinement provisions, on the other you've got Article 2, Section 15, because Article 2, Section 15 talks about the ability through a line of veto to strike or reduce. And so you have to very clearly, you know, have an articulated situation where you can find a very clear nexus between the one item and the other, such that in isolation, neither item has any value. Mm-hmm. All right. And so I certainly think that there are situations. I think those situations would be fairly rare. But, a room, you know, with no exit, I could figure one out probably pretty quickly. You know,
that is going to be the flashpoint at some point for a future legislature. Thank you. I just wanted to.
Yeah, but it gets evaluated on a case by case basis. And Mr. Chair, if I can just comment very briefly on what Representative Keller commented on, it really truly is about a process. And I think Representative Faircloth noted it in the context of a presentation to the House Finance Committee. The process for bills, appropriation bills that we talked about, that four-part process, is critical because it allows the vetting of situations and allows all the bodies to have a say into it. What you do by, you know, creating these agreements behind the doors, you emasculate that type of a process. And I think what you are emphasizing is what I think is very germane to the citizens of the state of Alaska. You know, in reality, who cares about the academics of it? You know, it is about process. It is about the transparency of government in doing things appropriately. The Constitution envisions that. Our obligation is to ensure that. And so I think yourself, other members who have articulated similar concerns are dead on as that being a primary focus of all this stuff. Thank you very much.
Okay. I can't get this gavel down.
In the audience, it made me
oh, yeah, I got startled myself. I thought we had a stroke happening. We're going to take a 5-minute break, and this gavel will come back down again in 5 minutes. Thank you. Judiciary is reconvening. We've gone through 2 hours of our 3-hour allotment, so I feel I'm cheating a little bit on Mr. Gardner, but he probably won't yell at me. I hope not.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Doug Gardner. I'm Director of Legislative Legal Services for the Legislative Affairs Agency, and also for the record, Chairman Gatto, I don't feel cheated. Thank you for your kind words about bagpiping. I'm glad you enjoyed the performance. I think it's important for me to say that this is not the usual forum for Director of Legislative Legal Services to be. I have a duty of confidentiality to 60 clients. Obviously,
some of them here.
Some of them here, I do, and I intend to answer all the questions put to me to the best of my ability. Nevertheless, we are by statute a policy neutral organization. I don't advocate on behalf in this presentation of any client, and we'll try and provide you with as balanced mm-hmm. a response to each question as possible. Because of that, I gave some thought as to how to start off, and I'm glad that Attorney General Burns gave an overview of the situation. I agree with a lot of the things that he has said. I disagree with some of the conclusions and analysis. I think that there's definitely another side to the any advocacy that occurs on this issue. But I did not prepare
a presentation deliberately, because I don't want to, having been in the DA's office for 9 years, I'm used to being an advocate. I don't think that that's my role now. I'm not advocating for a position. So I want to get into a situation where I do answer questions, but I have some remarks. There are three things that I want to respond to, and I'm going to respond just briefly in terms of framing where I see the issues. I agree with Representative Gruenberg. I don't believe that this is a confinement clause case. And unless the committee has other questions about confinement clause, I believe that the Hammond test is not violated by any of the provisions we've talked about, Section 4, intent language. I don't believe that there is anybody in the room that believes that Section 4 and the intent language would be legally binding on anybody. The appropriations in Section 4 and the allocations in Section 4 are just that. They have a stated purpose. There is an item, and the funding source has been identified. I do not believe this to be a confinement clause case. I do agree with, again, Representative Gruenberg and the Attorney General, to the extent that the issue's been framed, excuse me, as a separation of powers issue. This is a classic separation of powers issue between the legislative prerogative to appropriate and the executive's derivative power to strike or reduce in the line item veto. But I don't intend to talk about confinement clause any further unless there are questions. I do want to, before going any further, I do want to introduce Pam Finley, who is the senior attorney with Legislative Legal Service. I believe most of the members in the room know her. It was to some degree at Representative Gruenberg's suggestion that I asked Ms. Finley to come. She was counsel for legislative counsel in Ledge Counsel versus Knowles, the confinement clause case. I have to say that we collaborated on some of the memos that we drafted for you. And I hope that you noted, Chairman Gatto, her signature with mine, I believe, on the memo involving item. And I specifically asked her to contribute to that memo because as counsel in that case, she has a unique perspective. So when we get to questions in that area, I felt that it was appropriate for the members to be able to ask her those questions. With respect to, I guess I'm, and then with respect to the two issues that I see that remain, I agree with Attorney General Burns that the contingencies, the cross contingencies in what I call, what we'll refer to as Section 48, and as he did, just call them the contingencies from here on out, and the non-severability clause are the two main issues in this case. And with respect to the non-severability clause, I just want to say by way of an overview that there is the legislative prerogative to appropriate. In this particular case, Section 4, for people that are watching on television, Section 4 just deals with the energy projects. The non-severability clause just deals with that portion of the capital budget. And I think that was fairly clear, but just to reinforce that. But there's been a suggestion that there's, I guess you could describe it in pop culture terms, an imbalance in the force or some kind of an imbalance in the constitutional framework that brings us here. On one side of the scale is the legislative prerogative to appropriate. On the other side is the more limited power that the governor has, and I'm not minimizing that, but the Knowles decision calls it a more limited power, to strike or reduce. In this particular case, what the legislature has said is, at least so far, I don't mean to say legislature, it's only been through part of the process, but so far where the bill is, Senate Bill 46 articulates, and if it passes, it will be a legislative expression that if we can't do all the energy projects and fund them the way they are in the bill, we don't want to do any of them. The governor has the ability with this bill, and I understand that this puts a burden on the governor. There's no question that the legislature is pushing the envelope on its appropriation power. it places a very significant and perhaps in the eyes of some draconian result if the governor were to strike or reduce any of the amounts in the bill in Section 4. But what's the result of that? What happens if there's an appropriation that's contingent and ultimately the governor decides to go ahead and get his pen out? The result with the non-severability clause is if we can't do it the way we don't want to do it at all. The result of that is the parties come back to zero.
That's your notes up there.
Was the, as Ms. Finley says, that was the force imbalance. That's the power of it.
Someone's watching.
I appreciate the humor. But again, to back up, the net result is there's an appropriation, it's made contingent, and there is a strike or reduce action by the governor. The net result is both parties come back to zero. I would submit to you that one way to look at this situation is that that is a perfect balance that's still maintained, despite perhaps extreme situations where there is a large, there are a large group of projects tied together with contingencies, the governor acts, everything goes back to zero. And the money remains for appropriation, and perhaps the framers were wise and realized that both parties will ultimately need to work together in some way in order to move forward. I recognize that there's an alternate view. I spoke, I think Representative Gruenberg has articulated that in his memo, which is that there's another way that the court could look at this, and I respect Representative Gruenberg's analysis, which is the legislature appropriates, the governor uses a line item veto, and that the remedy is all contained within the four corners of Article 2 of the Constitution, which is a veto override. And I recognize that that's a paradigm that exists. It's certainly, it's there on paper. It's what the framers provided, and it is a possibility the Supreme Court would adopt that view and find somehow or another avoid the contingency analysis and not have to address the contingency. I don't know how easy that would be for the court to do that, but I recognize that other argument is there. One of the things that I one question that I thought was very insightful that was asked of Attorney General Burns was, can we do this a little bit? Are there fact patterns, and I think there are quite a few, and they're easy to think up. In previous conversations, I did speak about the hydroelectric project that Representative Gruenberg asked me to nod about earlier. Imagine the Snettisham project, a dam, a power line, an undersea cable, and a distribution center. Imagine those items as separate items. Or allocations within an appropriation. Would it be shocking? Well, first of all, they have a substantial nexus. It would be hard to argue that they don't, that the legislature would want one without the other.
And we've added one more, and that's avalanche control.
Okay. Okay. Fair enough. So some avalanche control pylons, and perhaps that would be a very key part. But it would be hard to conceive of a situation where the legislature wanted to appropriate the dam and the substation without the cable. And would it be shocking to the governor when he got out or she got out her pen and decided to strike those items? They're all separate items. No question that they're subject to strike or reduce. And so really it seems that looking a little deeper than just saying, well, we can't do contingencies because they burden the executive and they prevent a line item veto, strike, or reduce. It seems that the discussion needs to probe a little bit deeper. And this is part of the difficulty with lawyers providing an answer to what has ultimately been described as somewhat of a political conundrum in this situation. So we just don't know. We do know that in the Knowles case, there was a brief discussion, and I'm sure not suggesting the Supreme Court had this issue framed before it, But there was a discussion where the Supreme Court suggested that contingencies that are very closely related to the appropriation of the need, and I can pull the case and read that language to you, would be appropriate. Contingencies that are more that have less of a nexus, and that's my word, not theirs, but less of a nexus, less of a relationship, might not withstand scrutiny. The cases the Attorney General has cited in the Karcher case, there's no question that the court observed that most legislative appropriations do have some kind of a either a contingency or there's a reason for them. I don't believe that there have been any cases presented by either party that say that contingencies are a non-starter. That's also the difficulty in advising on this point, at least for us to our clients, is that there are cases that say, well, you can do it a little bit, cases that suggest you can do it a little bit, but it's not been defined how broad this is. I would agree with Attorney General Burns, and I think he said this maybe not as directly, and he can correct me if I'm wrong, that this is a broad contingency. This may be one of the broader contingencies that that the bodies have had to consider. And because it is broad, it does expose an argument that how is a wind generation project in one part of the state and an electrical transmission line in another part of the state and a heat pump, as Chairman Gatto referred to earlier, and there are many other ways to phrase that issue. How are those related? Is there enough of a nexus to them? I don't know the answer to that. And I don't know that the Supreme Court knows what it would do with that at this point. But a nexus, it would seem to me, would be one of those kinds of things where you look at it like the hydroelectric project and say, if I strike one of these things, I kind of get it that I'm probably eliminating the whole project. In this particular bill, the counterpoint to that is, if I were to strike a project in a wind generation project in Western Alaska, would I really, as governor, expect that I would be eliminating all of these projects? The countervailing point, I suppose, is that how would you describe and define a nexus? And in one of the last memos, I guess it does reflect our conversation, Representative Gruenberg decided to put it in here so I don't feel uncomfortable talking about that. But one of the thought processes that we explored was, what does a nexus mean? What would be a nexus that would be acceptable under the cases that have discussed that? Would it be a physical nexus? That's really what the hydro project is. The hydro project is both physical and financial, and probably functional. Maybe the result of this case will be that the Supreme Court will tell the legislature what type of contingencies and what scope that they may be. In this particular case, it could be argued that the nexus is an equitable distribution. At least one of the bodies that's passed the bill has articulated, and I noticed that there were speeches and other presentations included in the briefing packet, one from Senator Pascan. But what's been articulated is that this is an equitable distribution, at least in the eyes of members that have considered it so far, of energy projects in a very diverse state. Some parts of the state have different needs than others, but it's been cited that energy costs are a problem throughout the state. So if it's an equitable distribution, is that enough of a nexus to support a finding that the contingencies are constitutional? In other words, they don't offend the notion of strike or reduce. I believe there are arguments on both sides of that, and I believe that is a very difficult point for the court to decide, and don't really have an answer for that. But I think that those are the issues that are here before you. I do not believe that the confinement clause issue is a significant issue at this point, and I do respect Brian Bjorkas, but I don't agree with that as being a major issue in this case. With that, I would like to answer questions through the chair.
Okay. Could we, I asked Mr. Burns the same question. If we can have a nexus between two projects, or three, or 40, or 50, could we put the entire capital bill as a single project and say, this is infrastructure project for Alaska, send it to the governor and say, take it or leave it. Because I'm having the same trouble you are with, everybody would agree, the dam and the power line. One without the other has no meaning. But we don't agree that the windmill and the building a elementary school 800 miles apart are connected. So can we define a nexus? Has it been defined? And I doubt that, because it probably applies to so many different areas of concern that it may not be possible to define it.
We suggested some elements, and I have to say that in that memo to Representative Gruenberg of May 3rd, we don't certainly have a corner on that market. One court that did seem fairly comfortable in being ready to, I suppose is the way to put it, find the contingencies acceptable, had the legislature done a little better job of drafting and articulating why the contingencies went together, was the bus line, as I recall, the parking lot and the transit situation. The court in that case did not have a problem, and that's probably fairly analogous to the situation we've discussed with the hydro dam. I think that certainly you pose an extreme example. I am very aware that at some point this case may go to litigation, so I'm hesitating a little bit like the Attorney General was. It's difficult to, you don't want to paint yourself into a corner, but I would have a hard time arguing that an entire capital budget had the kind of nexus that was appropriate, that respected the governor, the executive's line item, strike or reduce, and also respected the legislature's ability to appropriate and address concerns with a tied nexus to them.
But this is just a subdivision of doing that and saying, well, we have four capital projects, 25% for each one. Take it or leave it. Take out three, take out two, take out one, leave them all.
And that's the nature of the problem, is we've now constructed sort of a hypothetical of the whole capital budget on one continuum that I don't think there's any disagreement would be a very extreme. I would think it would be unlikely a court would find that to be constitutional, that type of cross contingency. On the other hand, it didn't seem that it offended the notions of fair play and sensibility within the constitutional provisions to have an inner tie and a dam and so forth. And what we're presented with is something in the middle, probably more towards the upper end, and a little harder to defend, but fairly an equitable distribution argument within a class of projects, of energy projects. Is that enough? And I can't answer that question. I don't think there is a judicial answer right now for that. I think what I see Representative Gruenberg poised to ask a question, but I just want to say that I think that one of the issues that lawyers advise their clients about, and I have to think that both sides would be discussing this issue. I certainly would with ledge counsel in an executive session if this were an issue that went to litigation. But I think it's a fair principle just to throw out that when you go to the Supreme Court, legislature and the governor, over a novel issue of constitutional law, sometimes you have to be careful. You may not get what you want. You may get some intermediate position that may change the playing field and change how appropriations are done. It may hurt the executive, it may hurt my clients. And so sometimes the exploration of a novel constitutional issue has some real consequences. I just wanted to say that. Sure. But
you mentioned ledge counsel. They have some sort of a superior position with regard to making these determinations?
They convert us into advocates. If they make the if ledge counsel authorizes us to represent the legislature, then I don't have the conversation that I'm having with the members here. Then we become a little bit more of, well, we become advocates, and we become zealous advocates, and we take a position, and we essentially litigate with the folks sitting behind me about those things.
And how do you become an advocate when you have two parties that are in the legislature disagreeing?
And the gray you, hair. Do you the gray hair that I'm getting
one
is part
side
of that.
To Pam, and you take the other. Or?
Sometimes ledge counsel decides that LAA ought to litigate a case, and sometimes they hire outside counsel. Sometimes it's difficult for us to represent the legislature under certain circumstances where we are, but I don't see this as being one of those.
Got it.
That's why it's an awkward spot. That's why I'm in a policy neutral role right now wearing that hat, but I would change hats if ledge counsel authorized that.
Question, Representative Grunberg?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been a little simplistic, simply because I, with all the time I put in, hadn't completely, and I'm not sure I have now, completely thought the problem through. And by the way, that's one advantage in litigation. Most litigation, criminal litigation, sometimes goes pretty fast. But in this kind of litigation, you really have a lot of time to think the thing through, because particularly if it goes to the Supreme Court, you take it to the Superior Court first, which decides a question of law, but it's given no particular weight. But it's kind of a trial run to the Supreme Court and very helpful to the advocates. But we haven't considered, at least I haven't, a totally different dimension to the problem, and that is the dimension of time. And quite often there will be a reduction or a strike of an item, not because the executive feels it's not a good item, but because it's not affordable all at once. And you could have two things that are really tied together, like Mutt and Jeff, Burns and Allen, or whoever you want, but you just can't do them all at the same time. And that's why, and I think that, you know, we're sitting here, neither of us, well, you folks do represent the executive to, from a legal point of view, but not from the budget point of view. The governor and his or her people up in OMB will be concerned whether it's affordable at that point in time, particularly because we have the anti-lapse statute that gives these projects a five-year life before they have to go into the reappropriation mode. And if that were the basis for a reduction, or probably more a reduction than a strike, but potentially could be a strike, and we tie projects together in toto, that could cause a constitutional problem, in my opinion, because the governor has to be able not just to represent the state, but to represent the budget and the budget over time, and looking at the budget this year as a snapshot in time. And that, I think, argues strongly for the governor having the maximum flexibility in this area. And I had thought, and we had talked, and you were not in the room, Mr. Attorney General, a little bit about getting some legal opinions here. I don't think we should do that, because there are too many variables. And I think that the only question here, and I hope that the negotiation process will wind up eliminating these two clauses, which could litigation could cause more problems than it will solve. But at least with this hearing, and this hearing is different than the finance hearings, because we're truly focusing on the constitutional issue, and nobody else has done that. I hope this will get people thinking about this. And I think there's a very dangerous precedent to use these at all, because of the time issue, as well as probably others we haven't thought about. I think this has got more wrinkles than the rear end of a hippo. That's not a question.
There's a new twist.
A new twist.
I know you well enough, Representative Grunberg, to know that's not a question.
What do you think?
I think that as this process has gone on, that the non-severability clause has been changed and redrafted, as the members here probably noted earlier. I think that in and of itself demonstrates that that we're just at the beginning of talking about a very, very complex issue, and there are a lot of permutations that I haven't thought about, and that our office hasn't probably even thought about. And I don't know about the other side, but I think that there are a lot of real consequences to, as I said earlier, exploring a constitutional issue. It may very well be that the wisdom of the justices will be that they uncover an issue that neither of the parties talked about. And I was tracking your discussion. How would they deal with that? What would they do? Would they send it back? Would there be some result that we don't, that we haven't even been able to anticipate? So, I mean, that's about the only response I can have, Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, is that there is, I guess that goes back to my risk discussion, is when you get into you get into litigating things, there are risks, there are risks that you haven't thought of everything. If there's another question, I would like to talk a little bit about the non-severability clause at some point.
Representative Thompson?
I just wanted to bring up the question that I had asked Attorney General Burns about the third-party litigant and how it could bring the entire package to a halt. And what was your opinion on what he had to say on that?
When we were seated in the back of the room listening to that question, I indicated to Ms. Finley that I would like her to answer that question. She's the reviser of statutes, and I think would be better suited to answer it. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Pamela Finley. I'm the reviser of statutes. I work for Mr. Gardner. The question is third-party litigants. If the governor doesn't veto, do any line item vetoes, or if he does and the legislature overrides those vetoes, then a third-party litigant would have nothing to gain by litigating the constitutionality of any of this. Okay? Because what would happen is that the court might say, oh, yes, you know that this contingency, which really hasn't been triggered, probably was invalid, but the non-severability clause only is going to take effect if there's a veto and if there's not an override of that veto. So, yes, you anti-Susitna folks, you win in theory, but the project goes on. Now, if the governor vetoes it and the legislature doesn't override that veto, then many people may be in court. But I think the fear was that that even if the legislature and the executive branch didn't trigger this, that someone else could use it. And as it is now written coming out of the Senate, the third party could not use it to stop the Susitna or anything else. On the other hand, if the legislature and the executive branch are in court, then, yes, probably a third party could weigh in, too. Okay. Does that answer your question through the chair?
Yes, I think it does. It brings it up, though, that if future litigation was to take place on one of the, like Susitna, that would not have any effect backwards onto these items that are all in number four.
If the Susitna were challenged on some other grounds, yeah. Well, no, I don't think it would affect this.
Project 31 and Susitna's Project 40 mm-hmm. is challenged. The 40 projects, assuming it's total, have to go to limbo waiting for this challenge on one project.
Yes, certainly. Actually, it's probably somewhat worse than that, in that if the possibility of challenge is out there for these projects, that the contractors are not going to be willing to go ahead. Nobody's going to want to plan as long as they're in limbo.
I understand the contractor issue. I want to make sure I understand the legal issue, that Project 40 is just as vulnerable in a suit against Projects 1 or 3 or 9 or 18 as it is against Project 40.
Yes, that is true. Assuming that the contingency has been triggered and that we're all in court, yes. They all jump together.
That's an extremely powerful mm-hmm. conversation and statement about the issue of combining them together like that. Representative Thompson?
Yeah, just as another topic completely, the language that they use that the it's necessary to achieve statewide balance in addressing the state's diverse energy needs. Your nexus about is that equal to everybody in the state. I doubt if people in Kaktuvik or Nulato feel like it's equitable and equal to all of them.
Through the chair, I'll take that question. I didn't mean to suggest that that I was endorsing as a lawyer any of those arguments. I'm just observing that that language has been included by the Senate, has been placed in there, and that that would probably be one of the arguments advanced for the nexus. But I'm not endorsing or taking a position on it. I'm just observing it's there, much like the Attorney General did.
Thank you, Ms. Finley and Mr. Gardner.
One of the, through the chair, one of the other issues that I think is you know, I said I wouldn't say this, and now I'm going to say it. Sort of the 800-pound gorilla in the room, if you will, is the non-severability clause. And I think that it is very conceivable that an outcome could occur one way or the other on the nexus analysis. The law that I've been able to find, and I think that the case law that the Attorney General's been able to find, is that if the legislature includes a non-severability clause, basically that's an instruction to the court. It's basically telling the court, if this didn't work the way we want it to, don't guess about our intention. Don't try and read our minds. Don't try and sever things. Just take it out. So Section 4 would go away, limited to Section 4. And the jurisprudence in America, and I would say the majority opinion, and I think where it gets a little sticky, is how would the court apply a non-severability analysis in the context of appropriations where you have these two constitutional provisions. And I certainly respect some of the comments that Representative Gruenberg made about that. I think that there are issues there. We can't definitively say that the court won't carve out some type of a separate provision for a non-severability clause enforcement in the context of appropriations. But I think what we can say right now is that non-severability clauses get enforced. If the legislature says, if we can't do it our way, we don't want to do it at all, courts tend to look at the non-severability clause as they did in the Brown decision. And I realize there are some distinctions between all of these cases. I agree with Mr. Pogue. Those cases are as good as the state and the constitution and the law that's there. But those tend to get enforced, and there's no reason to suspect that that wouldn't be enforced. And so in the end, if the contingency is found to be unconstitutional, the net result may be, because of the non-severability clause, that there are no energy projects that go forward in the state under Section 4 of SB 46 the way it currently exists.
Okay. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have no recollection of ever seeing a non-severability clause in this state in an appropriation bill before. Does anybody on any of the lawyers in this room ever recall seeing? The answer is no.
Through the chair, I'm not sure that there's never been one. I just don't remember one, a non-severability. There may have been non-severability clauses in substantive legislation.
That's my second question, Mr. Chair. I would be grateful if we could informally request, I don't know if it's you folks in Ledge Legal or Ledge Research or the Attorney General, I would like a letter to the committee or to me, and we will disseminate it, whether there's ever been a non-severability clause in an appropriation bill in this state, and if so, I would like the details on that. And secondly, any other legislation and the details on that. I think it's important as part of our work on this that we include the history if there's ever been anything. We have seen, of course, severability clauses, but I mean a non-severability. This is going into, I think, quite uncharted waters, particularly in appropriations in this state.
Yes, through the chair, I'd just like to I think one of the problems with the contingency clause and the non-severability clause is that in this particular case, they end up at the same place, but they are conceptually quite different. And it might be easiest to understand if you think of the ASME appropriation in the Knowles case. In this case, the legislature said in the appropriation for ASME, this appropriation is contingent on ASME having no employees out of state above a range, 21, 22, somewhere in there. The court said that's a confinement. You've just violated the confinement clause. Then the next question was, do we sever your bad contingency from the appropriation? Or to put it more directly, does ASME get funded anyway or not? And in Knowles, the court said, well, we have this general statute that has a general presumption of severability. We don't want to discourage people. There's no non-severability clause there. So we'll sever them. I think a general. But I urge perhaps the members here to think, can you think of a situation where the legislature says, we really don't want to fund this project. Most of us really don't want to fund this. We're tired of it. But if they do it just this way, then we can get the 21 votes or whatever it is that we need. But if that contingency is no good, then we don't want to fund it. Then you'd put in a non-severability clause because you'd be saying to the court, this is the legislative intent. This is the legislative intent. We don't want to fund this. So that's why I just think that it's important perhaps to understand that these are different and that they can be different in different situations. Here they're mooshed together, and we lose that point. Thank you.
Excuse me. On this point?
Go ahead. On that point.
My question should include contingency clauses, too. You're absolutely right, and your suggestion, I don't know that it would make any difference constitutionally, whether in the I'm going to talk about the ASME case, because that's really part of Ledge Council v. Knowles. It's one provision and the one issue in there. Whether that would have made any difference to the court in its decision, because I could see on something like that they don't want money spent, let's say, on out-of-state labor. They want to make sure only Alaskans are employed in the project with state money. Whether that's constitutional or not is a different question under the Orbeck case. But, you know, and you know, the way you put it, Ms. Findley, from a legislative point of view, my heart and soul as a legislator was, sure, we ought to be able to put a string on the state's money. But and that's, of course, yet another part of the tangled yarn in this thing. So I hope in your research you can let us know if there are any contingency things and how this all relates. This is not an easy subject.
And didn't we get burned in the Carlson case on charging out-of-state fishermen a higher rate than in-state fishermen? And is that a contingency?
No, it wasn't really a contingency. It was just a violation of the Constitution. It was an entirely different way of doing it.
That's different.
Yes, it's different. Yeah. You're correct, though, that it is related to the ASME contingency that I mentioned, but the court struck down the ASME contingency not for the same reason that it struck down the Carlson, but because this was an attempt to put substantive law into an appropriation. That if you wanted to try to, if the legislature wanted to try to do that, they needed to pass a law that says that ASME may not employ people from out of state. And it might have been unconstitutional, but at least it should have been in substantive law if it was going to be anywhere.
So can we insist on an oil company that they have 80% Alaskan hire?
That's a good question. I'm not prepared to answer it at the moment.
Okay. Representative Keller?
Thank you. thanks for coming over. Doug, you gave us kind of a cautious caution, let's put it that way, and going to court, and unintended consequences, of course, is something that we deal with all the time. Can you think of any situation where it would be wise for us to cast ourselves at judicial review? Can you think hypothetically of any time that would ever happen? We've heard some pretty fluent, well put together arguments that that's what we ought to do in this case. And I personally, you know, am revolted because, to me, the judicial review, the balancer here is thorough vetting. You know, in other words, if you thoroughly vet an item, okay, let's use the word item, then your contingency or your non-severability language, for example, has a lot of meaning, because then it's based on debate, records, that kind of thing, you know, but to just throw it in. My question is, would you please comment in general more about, is it ever appropriate for the legislature to look to judicial review to solve our problems with legislation like this?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I don't want to evade the question. I really don't. I want to be careful not to comment on policy, and I think sometimes policy, when you go to court, you find out an answer, hopefully, to the question you ask. As Representative Gruenberg suggested, it may be that that question ends up being formulated differently as time wears on. I think that lawyers are generally risk averse and would prefer to have their clients control their own destiny. And I know and I respect Representative Gruenberg for the work he does in court, and I'm guessing just from our conversations that he tries to keep clients out of court as much as possible so that they can control their lives, so that they can, you know, I suppose the analogy here is so you can, you know, work to a resolution. I think that that's always preferable. I can't imagine many situations, unless it is a true, true, unresolvable crisis where a constitutional matter has to be unraveled for anybody to go forward and there is no other door to open. In that situation, I think a constitutional issue has to be answered. But I think when there are other doors to open, I think the lawyers would be saying, try the knobs first if you can. And I would be risk-averse in a novel constitutional issue like this one.
I think you did not avoid the question at all. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Representative Gruenberg.
Mr. Chair, I don't know. You had said maybe this is the time for questions, because I see Representative Seaton's been sitting here.
Yeah.
Every weekend.
Do you have a question? Would you come up and just take one of the microphones? He's been here the whole time listening, and it's probably collected at least one question, not more. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the information you provided earlier on the non-severability, and it seems to be the second brown portion of that, and all seems to be very applicable. But I guess, you know, as I'm sitting here listening, I mean, I guess the final question about figure out other ways to do things is what we do a lot, because, I mean, we were talking about fair and equitable distribution or balancing. We do that all the time on schools, and we do that all the time on lots of projects. So I guess that's the political part of this instead of the legal part of it. But I guess my greater question was on item and allocation. And in the current version of the bill, many things have been moved from an item column to an allocation column. And just my understanding is that if it's an allocation, then the agency, with the consent of OMB, can move those appropriations around, can change the numbers.
I think that Ms. Finley is best suited to answer that question from a revising standpoint and her experience with budget.
Yeah. The point of the allocation is to allow that you have, say, three bridges, and one is costs a little more and one's costs a little less. The legislature essentially is allowing the executive branch to move that money a little bit through, but they have to get OMB's approval. OMB has to keep control of that. I have serious doubts that if the legislature passed an appropriation that had an allocation for three bridges, that the executive branch could decide to build one bridge and not the other two and just move all the money to the one. I think that that would probably be a violation of the appropriation power. But the issue has not been decided. It's not been litigated. Why else would the legislature actually list those bridges unless it wanted those bridges to be built? Also, I suspect that if the executive branch started ignoring allocations and just using the money for the one bridge, I suspect that the legislature would stop doing allocations very quickly.
But they could say, you know, the bridge over the Yukon is clearly one that we need to get done more quickly if we're going to carry heavy pipe, and take two-thirds of the money from bridges B and C, put it all into bridge A, and that's not enough money to finish B and C, but we can get them started and then get some more money from the legislature later. That'd be a reasonable thing to do.
I just don't know how that would be seen, either by the legislature or as a whole, mm-hmm. or by a court if the issue got there. Certainly they can move some money.
Right. And that's the question I had was some money, a little money, move enough so that you don't bother anybody. Well, if you had money you could move from Bridge B, we overfunded Bridge B then. And that was never our intent.
I think that is why, actually, they do allocations, because the amount needed for those allocated things is not certain. It's an approximate amount, and you may come in over and under for one, so they allow that adjustment.
Just on that point for one question.
Okay, and then I'll go to Representative.
Thank you. Are you talking about something that's in this bill, or is that a hypothetical?
No, there are
there are allocations, through the chair, there are allocations in Section 4. There are also there are appropriations and then allocations for that appropriations, and then there are some things that are just appropriations. The big hydro projects, for example, are all appropriations.
I just wanted to look. I was going to try to find the language. Thank you. I'll look in the bill. I'm sorry.
Well,
but I don't need any further questions.
In the cover letter, it says Section 4, the projects are now listed as allocations, and the CS modifies the intent language, et cetera. So on the cover page here, I think it was Miles that was reading all these changes that were occurring in the most recent CS, and he used the term, the projects are now listed as allocations. So that was a significant change to the...
I don't seem to have that. I'll find it. We'll get it. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm not sure that was a question. That was an answer. So, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, this result revolves around the issue that I'm talking about. When it went from version C to version S that passed out, they were changed from items to allocations.
Did, right?
And so I guess my real question is, with these showing up as allocations, a whole list of energy mm-hmm. projects from a diverse across the state, where you were talking about the effect of fair and equitable balance and regional balance. Now, if we have all of these energy projects as allocations, and if the governor has it's the executive, it's the agency in OMB, so it's the executive that now has the authority to change those allocations amounts. And so I guess my question is, if they're not vetoing or reducing a certain project, just not going to spend half of the money on that project and spend it somewhere else, especially if that's increasing the amount of a allocation, isn't that, by doing an allocation, aren't we actually giving the executive our power of appropriation for a project that now gets more money than previously been designated?
Through the chair, yes, allocations give more power to the executive branch in deciding where the money gets spent. If the legislature wants it only to be spent on X, then it has to do an appropriation to X. If it's willing to allow a little movement, then it can do an appropriation plus allocations of that appropriation. As far as the line item, perhaps I did not understand your question, but I should say that historically, governors have used the line item veto on allocations and changed the amount of the appropriation up above. That's just what has happened pretty much, I think, since statehood. But that may not be what you're asking. I just wanted to say that so that that would be clear.
So if we have an appropriation and then we decide it's allocated 50% to A and 50% to B, and the governor moves it 60-40, and the 40 now, you can't build a half an aircraft carrier, you can't build half an airplane, you can't build half a bridge, you can't build a lot of things when you have 40% instead of 50. So he's essentially vetoed one of the allocations.
Yes, Representative Gatto, that is why when you asked whether or not you could move like all the money to one bridge instead of the... I was reluctant to say yes, because I think that it does undermine the legislature's allocation power if you could do that so radically that something that the legislature thought it was going to get, it's not going to get. And as the law is uncertain on this. I'm just giving you my general reluctance to bless that.
Representative Seaton?
And I guess my concern is on the other aspect of that, not of the veto, but the power that's given to the governors to strike or reduce. And in this case, the allocations, we're allowing him to increase.
Can I answer that question?
Yes. Representative Seaton, through the chair, I have an example from the bill. For example, and I'm on page 99 of, and I may not have exact. I think so, and I hope that that's what it is. But in any case, there's a $16,000,000 $330,000 appropriation for the Alaska Energy Authority. It's been broken down into allocations: $1 million for the Alaska Energy Plan, $5 million for bulk fuel upgrades, $330,000 for electrical emergencies. And the rural power system has $10 million. I hope I said all those numbers correctly. I think that the point that Ms. Finley's trying to make, and maybe it helps to show by an example, is, for example, if the governor, the executive, I should say, decided to take a line item veto and draw a line through the $1 million on the Alaska Energy Plan, the practice for the executive has also been to go up to the main appropriation and turn that into a $15,330,000. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly, the practice has been a mutual respect between the line item veto and the legislature being willing to give enough flexibility to put things in allocation. So there hasn't been a net result where the other projects within that category of appropriation have been increased.
Sufficient?
On that point.
Representative Gruenberg?
There's a case that says he must reduce the full appropriation, because otherwise the effect would be to increase the remaining three items. And I forget what case that is, but there's an Alaska Supreme Court case directly on point, as I recall.
I think you're right.
And if he couldn't reduce, I mean, there's no way he could reduce if the money simply drifted up to a different place.
And therefore, because he can do that with that result, for him to be able to do what I think Representative Seaton was concerned that he might do, which is to move it without vetoing it, mm-hmm. I think that might be an illegal use of the appropriation.
Is that an illegal use of the veto?
Of the appropriation.
How about the veto when you don't veto it, no, but you simply remove the allocation?
Yeah, I thought it was.
That's a veto.
It was illegal use of a veto.
Use of the veto.
Yeah. Okay.
I do have a question along the same line.
Go ahead.
I don't know the letter you were referring to, Mr. Chair.
This is changes to version E, and I guess the changes occur to version appear in version S.
This was from something, I don't know. Maybe at some point, if you're willing to share that,
sure.
I'd like to get there. But where does it define the term, quote, allocation? I don't, maybe it appears in other bills. I don't recall seeing it. And I don't, is it defined in here through the chair, Ms. Finley?
No, through the chair, it is not defined. It is used in the Executive Budget Act where it says that you cannot transfer money between appropriations, but you can transfer it between allocations.
Is there a problem with the constitutionality of that?
Conceivably. A delegation issue?
Yeah.
Yes, conceivably.
Exactly.
I guess you
obviously thought about this. You know, what did they say in Star Trek? You go where no man is.
Thank you. Or not, as it were.
Yes,
don't go. Okay.
Right.
Any other questions from the committee? Well, this is good. Any questions from the audience? This is great. 5 minutes to 11, which was the goal, was to go no further than 11 o'clock. Representative Gruenberg.
I'd like to thank particularly Attorney General Burns and his family for allowing him to come today and wish him have a happy vacation.
And
anybody else who's in
and the committee, and I'll speak for the whole committee, really does appreciate that you could be here at 8 o'clock, listen to, spend 3 hours with us, probably saying those lunkheads, maybe they need a lot more than 3 hours or so. But for us, it was more than important in that I feel that there's been a great deal of conversation, and whether or not we want to take side A or side B, to me, has somehow been remedied in one way that... If I start out like we did several months ago, well, when we first saw the first capital budget, this is wrong, and then change ourselves to, I think this is wrong, rather than to be so obstinate that we already know what the right and the wrong things are. So I do appreciate that you came here. And with that, unless there's any objection, we are adjourned.